Thank you. I would like to thank Anne for organizing this conference and inviting me to present something on India-China. I had initially thought of presenting something on I Ching, the other Chinese monk who traveled to India, and Tim has written about him as well, whether or not he actually went. But it's good to be in presence of Tim as well. I think he is one of the foremost experts of India-China connections. Here, what I would like to do is actually talk about the two main sources on Xuanzang's travel to South Asia. There has been, I think, a lot of confusion in merging the two together and creating the voyage or trip to India, his meeting with Indian kings and so forth. I think my main argument here in the presentation is that we should separate these two sources. One is, of course, Xuanzang's records of the his trip to India during the Great Tang Dynasty, and the other one is the biography, which is substantially about his trip to South Asia as well. So I think we need to separate these two, otherwise we come up between what may have been historical and what was totally legendary, because it's the disciples who were writing the biography of Xuanzang. Unfortunately, the two have merged, and many of the issues, I think, have been overemphasized as historical, while I would argue perhaps not so. The one example that I would try to give is his meetings with the Indian rulers, Harsha, for example, and the ruler of Kamarupa. If you bring in the biography, you will see a very exaggerated image of Xuanzang, and this perhaps would help us make Xuanzang a human rather than a hagiographical hero that the biography tries to portray him. He does play an important role in the diplomatic connections between the Tang court and Indian polities. I'll just try to mention that as his one of his main contributions as well, not just Buddhism, but also diplomatic connections. So these are the three things I would like to talk about. I'm sure many of you know about Xuanzang, but I'll just highlight some of the important aspects of him. We do not know exactly when he was born, so there's a question mark. Sometimes it's 600, 602, and other dates, but we know he passed away in 664. He leaves, again, his date of departure is also a bit controversial, either 629 or 630. He comes to know about Nalanda. We know where exactly he's going from an Indian monk, and that connection, which a Japanese scholar called Koyama Shosin actually discussed about how Xuanzang actually came to know about Nalanda and how he decided to go there. So he, before he left China, he knew exactly where he was going and what he was looking for. He had an interest in this new kind of teachings that was developing in and around Nalanda in the 4th century, the Yogacara, and so he was interested in texts related to Yogacara. So this knowledge and his connection with an Indian monk living in China is, I think, an important facet that is also not being emphasized. How did Xuanzang actually know about what's going on in India before he leaves? The other issue is that he, unlike Fa Xian before him and I Ching after him, Fa Xian, as you know, went by the land route, came by the sea route. I Ching traveled by the sea route and came back by the sea route. Xuanzang traveled by the land and came back by the land route. Different, little bit different itineraries on the way and back. He visited various famous Buddhist sites, studied in Nalanda Mahavihara, met various foreign rulers, and this is where we come to, were these rulers interested in him, or was he interested in meeting with these rulers? I think it's an important question, and I think Xuanzang is quite manipulative later on, especially when he becomes very close to the Tang rulers about his own importance. This we can see before the biography is even compiled. So he brought with him about 657 Buddhist texts, various kinds of relics, and other souvenirs. There was display of some of what he brought in Chang'an. So by the time he comes back, Anne was pointing out he left without permission. I think that's a later Tang phenomena rather than when Fa-hsien went. And this is also happening when the Tang dynasty is being stabilized and Central Asia is not very stable. So there was a reason for not letting people out easily for security purposes as well. After he returns to Tang China, he comes and becomes very close to the reigning emperor, Tang Kaizong, who initially asks him to be part of his endeavor against Korea to join his army. Being a monk who has returned from India is quite auspicious, and that's why he thought that Xuanzang's presence during the battles would be a benefit to the Tang. Then when Xuanzang turns down that invitation, he is asked to then compile his records of the Western regions. The main purpose for Tang Taizong to know about this place is perhaps may have been strategic, to figure out what is happening in Central Asia through somebody who had eyewitnessed all these regions. After Taizong, Xuanzang also becomes close with the next ruler of Tang Dynasty, the Emperor Kaozong. And together they spend a lot of time and sort of an advisor to Kaozong as well. What is very interesting is that this communication with Nalanda and his teachers and fellow students remains. There are later exchanges, and this is how we can see the circulation of information, knowledge, and objects continues after Xuanzang comes back. Well, I think that, again, is an important aspect of Xuanzang's contribution to the connections between the two places. He does establish a school called Fa-hsien School related to Yogacara teachings. Not very successful compared to many other schools, but clearly he was one of the founders of a school in Tang China. Now, the focus of this presentation is comparing these two sources on his trip to, I won't call it pilgrimage because I don't think he was going on pilgrimage as such, and this is where Max Deek and I agree that I think this was, calling it a pilgrimage would perhaps take away the reason why he's going to Nalanda to study and understand a specific doctrine. But the records of that he writes and the biography offer, in many places, two very different kinds of pilgrimages, if that's what the second one really tries to do. The records narrated, most likely by Xuanzang, written by PNC in 646, a year after Xuanzang returns to China. It was written, and we should not forget, for a particular person. I think the audience here is very important. This was asked about Fa-hsien. I think Fa-hsien was writing for the Chinese monks in China. Xuanzang is in particular writing for Tang Taizong's eyes. The focus of the text is on the description of these places that he visited, the sacred lands, stories related to these sites. So he offers how these sites became sacred, descriptions of various relics and relic venerations, the legend of Ashoka, which is also, I think, important for Tang Taizong to know how an Indian ruler behaved with regard to Buddhism, many other Buddhist figures, his meetings with Harsha and Kumara from Kamarupa, his stay in Nalanda, and he does quite an interesting thing in the beginning of his chapter on India, is he talks about the misperception of the term India. I think that's also quite interesting about how he says, but he comes to a wrong conclusion about where the word Hindu comes from. He thinks it comes from the moon. But so he has this discussion about the name for India, which I think is also an important part of his records. The biography then was written by the disciples of Xuanzang, Hoyle and Yinsung, but it's not written at the same time. There are huge problems textually in this text. The first five chapters, perhaps written by Hoyle, later revised by Yinsung, and who then adds five more chapters to his basically roles. And so the actual compilation of this text is problematic to start with. Who is writing what? Who is adding what? So there are various sectarian issues involved at this time. The disciples of Xuanzang perhaps also contending with other Chinese monks and so forth. So there is a reason to highlight Xuanzang in a different way. The work was completed much later, after the death of Xuanzang in 664. The focus is clearly on this Xuanzang, not just as a monk, but he is the master, intellectual, a very important diplomat. His meetings, therefore, with the kings, emperors, Taizong and Kaozong, description of his sites, victories in debates, intimate relationship with Taizong and Kaozong are all highlighted. I think it's very clear that there is an agenda to promote Xuanzang as a major figure here, which we don't see in Xuanzang's own narration or writing of his records. Just a comparison part of this, I'll come back to another comparison later on about how these two texts differ. The biography is, of course, the later one. The records is by Xuanzang. Here you can see about places, and usually in the biography it will be mostly the rulers of foreign polities inviting Xuanzang to come or go looking for him. No such thing is found in the records. For example, in the case of Yiwu, where in the biography we see that the king himself invites Xuanzang to his residence. This is not mentioned in the records. The more important and often cited one is from Kaochang, where there is this king, important king of Kaochang, who requests Xuanzang to be sent to his kingdom, and he goes out of the palace to the city and invites him, welcomes Xuanzang from the gate inside. No description in the records. So whether this meeting takes place or not. Again, with Agni, this is a pattern. The king is always meeting, but records, if they even mention the place, do not talk about meeting with the king in many places. The Turkish ruler, also same thing. And he talks about the city more than the ruler. Samarkand, same with that. And in the biography, it becomes very clear that overall, Xuanzang is a representative of Tang China. In the records, Xuanzang tries to say that he is visiting all these places. He is more of a pilgrim rather than anything else as a representative of the Tang. So it becomes very clear that there are distinctions between the two sources that we have. Let's say in Kaochang, the king, this is a description about how the king overplaying the role of Xuanzang. In the biography, the king and his attendants with candles in their hands were walking in line, came out of the palace to receive the master and ushered him to sit behind a precious curtain in a storied pavilion in the inner court. The king worshipped him and asked him about his journey in a very cordial manner, saying, "Since I, your disciple, heard the name of the master," I don't know if they had actually heard about his name at all, "I have been so happy that I have forgotten to sleep and take food." Very, very important things. "Computing the distance of the way, I guess that you would arrive tonight, and so my wife and I did not sleep, but waited for your arrival while we recite his scriptures." Certainly made up. And this kind of thing doesn't happen in record. Moving to where he gets into India, and these pictures are quite interesting. These are from Japan. The story of Xuanzang was then made into various kinds of illustrative things, including his description of India and so forth into a map. But this is his journey. He goes, travels a number of different places, and he travels quite extensively, writes about them, writes about places that he does not visit. Sri Lanka, for example, where he does not visit, he writes about Sri Lanka. An important source for Indian history at this time, as we look at his records in particular, and people have used that to reconstruct Indian history. So going back to some of these things about specifically about what he is writing about India and the records, or what he is narrating in his records and the biography of his disciples. Now, how does he enter India? These are quite differently done. He enters in the record from northern India through Kapisa. Clear geographical division he makes between central Asia and India. He says, "I'm entering into India at this moment." In the text, he basically lumps these things together. The disciples, I think, they don't have much idea about the geographical location that Xuanzang is describing, and that's why there are problems in the geographical description about how Xuanzang is entering. The King Harsha is mentioned in the fifth chapter in the Kanyakubja, which is the polity that Harsha rules. He's described in the records as a strong supporter of Buddhism. Xuanzang appears immediately in the biography. I mean, again, the role is to highlight his connection. And it says Harsha might well be compared to Sudana, a very important Buddhist figure, so highlighting the importance of Harsha as a key Buddhist figure. While we are not very sure that he was totally a Buddhist, he may have supported it, and this is the case with Ashoka as well. The meeting with Harsha mentioned in the same chapter in the records, but Xuanzang clarifies that the meeting took place only after Xuanzang first visited Kamarupa. This is an important chronological, and so understanding the meetings are quite important to see what happened when. In the biography by the disciples, in the first encounter with Harsha, it takes place in a dream, and I'll show you the dream later on, in which Manjushri, this famous Buddhist divinity, tells Xuanzang that Harsha is going to die in 10 years. Perhaps he should do something about it. Meeting with this other king, an audience, when he is in with the Kamarupa king, he then is threatened by Harsha, "You better come and see me very quickly, otherwise I'll have your head." So there is this highlighting the importance of Xuanzang, not only as he's about to visit Harsha, but the dream, I think, is also very important. And this is what happens later on. Clearly, you can see this biography is written after the death of Harsha, and they know what has happened to Harsha. Limited details about Xuanzang's interactions at Nalanda, even the records does not have much. But in the biography, there are lots of details about his experience in Nalanda. So how much of it can we take it historically is something that we have to be careful about. His discussions with teachers, certainly, I don't know how many of you have seen this movie, Xuanzang. The Chinese just made it with India, and he speaks Sanskrit in that movie. But clearly, that movie is partially based on the biography, so it is problematic nonetheless. But clearly, every time there's a debate, he is a hero, he's the winner, he defeats everybody. And I think we have to be, again, careful about his time in Nalanda. In the records, getting down to the meetings with the kings here, what we have in the records, Xuanzang gives a background of Harsha, who is also known as Siladitya. He is from which class? He comes to become the king after his brother is assassinated. He is a humble person. He is a Buddhist. He has a conversation with Avalokiteshvara. He avenged the murder of his brother. He performs various good deeds, performs various ceremonies. He built various monuments at Nalanda. And here I think it is very important to keep in mind the audience is Tang Taizong here. And he's describing an idol Buddhist ruler supportive of the Buddhist cause. And again, in this case, the records themselves must also be used with caution. Now, his first meeting, according to Xuanzang, takes place only when he is in Kamarupa. He has not seen Harsha before this. Then Harsha demands that Xuanzang attend the assembly of Buddhist monks that he is organizing. Then he comes and meets Harsha together with the king of Kamarupa, and there's a dialogue between Xuanzang and Harsha, and Indian king's knowledge about the Prince of Qin. This is again, I think, should be used with caution here, where he talks about nice things about Taizong. I know that Chinese emperor, he is really very nice and a man of unusual bravery. And this, by this time, Taizong was actually a very unliked figure as such. He had killed many of his brothers and so forth. So he was also problematic. But of course, Xuanzang, when he's writing for Taizong, cannot say that, you know, you did all these things. He attends then assembly organized by Harsha. That's it in the records. But in the biography, then some things are common. Harsha's genealogy appears. His throne and the assassination of brother also appears. Then they try to modify further Harsha's image, an intelligent, righteous, and able king. Wherever his prestige reached and his moral influence functioned, the people submitted to rule of virtue. This is, I think, comparing him to Taizong. An Ashoka-like figure, no slaughter of animals, prohibition of eating meat. We don't know if that actually took place. Gifts to monk, construction of monastery, giving of alms. In consideration of his deeds, Harsha Siladitya might well be compared with Sudana. This is comparing him with the Buddhist figure here. The most interesting part, I think, is the dream that Xuanzang has of Harsha. This is clearly a much later edition when the things are very clear what has happened to Harsha and Xuanzang has died. So in the monastery, the master saw that villages towns outside the monastery in Nalanda were all burned to ashes. The golden figure, Manjushri, may have said, "You may return home soon. 10 years from now, the kind Siladitya of this place will pass away and India will fall into a state of great turmoil. Then evil people may do harm. You should be aware of this. So save yourself, return back to China." So it also says, and this last part, the last sentence is important because he quotes or points out the disciples that they perhaps got the information from the Chinese diplomat Wang Xuanzi, who had gone after Xuanzang to India. So this this Wang Xuanzi also wrote about his trip to India. The manuscript is now lost, but is available in various quotations. So they were clearly, the biographers were clearly aware of what had happened to Harsha. The first meeting is described in this biography as Harsha being very angry to learn that he had first went to Kamarupa, and why didn't he come and see me? I have repeatedly invited him, but he did not come. Why is he now in his country? This is Harsha writing to the other Indian king. Heated exchange take place. I mean, this is story writing between Harsha and Kumara with regard to Xuanzang. And Kumara then appears to eventually have submitted that I'll bring Xuanzang to you. This is entirely highlighting again the importance of Xuanzang, two various kings of India vying for him. This would be similar to Kumara Jiva, who had earlier, in the same way, taken to China. So there are subliminal issues involved when we are reading these kinds of descriptions. They want to push a point that this figure is important. The biography dialogue, then there's a whole extensive dialogue between Xuanzang and Harsha. So why didn't you come see me earlier? Harsha asks. Busy learning at Nalanda, Xuanzang says, I'm busy. Even greater than a king, he can say, I'm a busy person. Harsha is eager to learn about Taizong, and then Xuanzang makes various praises of Taizong, and Xuanzang then gives gifts to Harsha. And we do not know exactly what to make of this, but people have used it as a historical thing. Also very important in this part is where Anne's picture would come in later on, is the ceremony that Xuanzang attends a very elaborate ceremonial description about how Xuanzang is very close to Harsha, and they participate in all those things. But then the last point here is when Xuanzang has decided to leave, how Harsha is so sad and weeping and so forth to see him go, that he starts sobbing and so forth, and gives him various kinds of provisions, including Anne's elephant that basically perhaps was used by the Buddha first, and then this is again from Japan about the possession that's taking place during the ceremony. With regard to the other king, and this will be the last part basically here. So Kumara, this other king, is in present-day Assam. He is Brahmin, righteous, able king, sent messenger to invite Xuanzang when he was in Nalanda. This is from the records. Then Xuanzang is encouraged to go by his teacher to see this king. Kumara seems to be a major supporter of Nalanda, and that's why Xuanzang's teacher advises that he should go visit. And he does go and visits Kumara in Assam. His meeting in the records then is also a dialogue form. Upon hearing your fame, I venture to extend the invitation. Again, this is, I think, should also again be taken with caution. The dialogues that he is having with Kumara, again emphasizing that he is writing for Taizong about how a proper Indian ruler, a Buddhist ruler, should be. And so he then attends the final ceremony with Harsha together. In the biography then, the narrative changes a lot. Again, dreams are quite important, how he comes to know about the king. And the biography clearly emphasizes the spiritual nature of his travel. He is not only traveling, but he is dreaming, and he is dreaming about future. And that part of narrative, I think, is important to make Xuanzang here an important, godly, divinity kind of a figure. And they're also, again, emphasizing the role of Xuanzang, again, pointing out Harsha had threatened the other Indian king if he did not come and see him. There are other parts clearly on the Xuanzang Kumara meeting in the biography that are highly doubtful, how long he stayed, what kind of interactions the two of them had, and how they again bid farewell to Xuanzang with Harsha. Again, most likely these are not historical things, especially this eulogy in the biography. And this is when Xuanzang is departing. Upon seeing him, that is Xuanzang, King Siladitya or Harsha, and others applauded with delight, prostrated themselves before him and their elbows on the ground to kiss his feet and offered him all the valuable that they had in their possession. This, I think, relates to Anne's issue about whether or not monks should bow down to the rulers or the rulers should bow down to the monks. And clearly what he's saying is, look, in India, this is what happens, because exactly at this time this debate is going on when he writes whether or not monks should bow to the sovereigns. Just a couple of slides about his role. I think this is important despite all the problems between the two sources. What Xuanzang does, and I think it's mostly for his personal reason, and that's why I think there is a personal issue in Xuanzang. He wants to basically push his own agenda as well. Interacts with Taizong and Kaozong very intimately. He is credited for establishing diplomatic relations between Tang China and Kanauj, Harsha's kingdom. He maintains contacts with whoever is going to India. He gives letters to them. They bring back things for him. And so these letters are through the diplomatic envoys he's quite aware of. He meets the Tang envoy and comes to know about passing of his teacher. He meets one of the sculptors who is going to India. He writes to his teacher and colleagues that, look, I've lost these texts. Can you send those texts to me again, since they fell in the Indus River? But then he is also asked, and this is something that is quite interesting, and Pellio has written about this, about translating Tao Te Ching into Sanskrit. I won't go into this detail, but I think it's a very interesting episode where then the Tang ruler is asking Xuanzang to do something that is not Buddhist, and Xuanzang says, and there's a doubt about whether or not he does translation, but initially he says, look, it's too difficult to understand these Taoist stuff. I can't do it. I'm not that good a linguist. But so let me end up with the conclusion. I think the main point being that I think we need to distinguish between the records and the biography about the meetings, not only with the kings, but other rulers in Central Asia, and even Taizong and Kaozong. He may have gone to Kamarupa and met the king. We don't know how this meeting took place to convert him to Buddhism. That's what his teacher says that should do. The meeting with Hersha, I think, was more chance rather than a major meeting. There's a biography of Hersha by Bana. There's no mention of Xuanzang in the text. There's actually no mention of any Chinese in that text. Meetings are clearly glorified in the biography, demonstrating that Xuanzang was a celebrity in India, and that's why he should have the same status, not at the court, but among the Chinese Buddhists. Xuanzang, it seems, was actually responsible for some of the diplomatic exchanges that took place between Tang China and India, but I think it's for personal reasons. He would push it on Taizong and Kaozong, please send an envoy to India. And so his role as a celebrity, his role in connecting India and China diplomatically is something I think we have to look at it more detail and with critical eye, rather than accepting what has been written in both the records and the biography. Thank you.